I'm Ruby Redstone.
And I'm Lara Johnson-Wheeler.
And we want to invite you to get dressed with us.
Or at least think about getting dressed.
While we talk about getting dressed.
This is a transatlantic podcast about fashion, where we explore what it means to have a relationship with clothes, the issues both personal and political garments can raise, and our own ever-evolving philosophies of dress.
Hi, Lara.
Hi, Rue. How are you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I am trying to take a leaf out of Esther Perel's book when she asks people to be really honest with the how are you. So I am doing emotionally quite well under the circumstances and trying to take time to be as honest with myself as possible.
Wow, that's very un-British of you to give a true answer to how are you. So I appreciate that.
That's very true.
Tell me what you're wearing today before we get into our topics of discussion.
I'll start with my jewelry because I did do that this morning. I'm wearing a necklace that my grandmother gave me. My grandmother was by birth. She was born in Sagoda in what is now Pakistan. And for my 18th birthday, she gave me this very beautiful gold necklace from India that she had as a child. So I'm wearing that. Interestingly enough, with another designer of Indian heritage, I'm wearing a necklace on top of it by Alighieri. And what else am I wearing? Oh, I'm wearing a red Molly Goddard smocked dress that skims very nicely over anything, so it's quite comfortable to wear during the day. And whilst I was wearing a pair of Miu Miu clogs from the Spring Summer 10 collection with red birds on them, I have taken those off because I was trying to kind of wear them in a bit, and now I've reverted back into my socks and Birkenstocks working from home combination with my hair in my slightly greasy hair in a bun.
Wow, we are twins because when I head out for the day, I'm wearing socks and stocks, but also
socks and stocks.
I have those clogs too in the pink daisy print. I didn't know you had them, and they're the most uncomfortable shoes ever. They are so freaking high that they are impossible to wear.
They are insanely high. They're a recent eBay purchase. So what are you wearing, Rue, with your socks and stocks?
With my socks and stocks, I'm wearing some tan Carhartt overalls. They're actually my sister's, but I have a similar pair, so we can share these. And the white blouse, actually, that I think I was wearing last time we recorded, this white Aurora Van Milhelm blouse that is handmade. And then I've got on a little pearl necklace with a pink strawberry on it that I ordered a couple weeks ago in lockdown from this woman in London who handmakes jewelry. Her Instagram is Margot Studios. And some pearl earrings.
Oh yeah, you recommended her to me and I bought Anise one of her earrings for her birthday.
Oh, cute. Oh, this conversation reminds me also, one of our very sweet listeners messaged me and said, I love hearing about your outfits, but I can't visualize it at all. Is there any way you could put a picture in the show notes of what you guys are wearing? So I'm going to try to figure out how we can link a picture of our outfits in the show notes for anyone who might care about that.
Very cute. I used to take lots of pictures of my outfits when I was on Instagram. But disclaimer, I have been off Instagram fully for nearly 3 weeks, which has done wonders for my mental health, but has really changed how I've been kind of consuming fashion and being inspired by the ways that people are putting together outfits, something that I'm sure we'll delve into a little more. But also I think leads us into something that we obviously want to discuss, which is the recent racial injustice movement and the anti-racism protests that have been sparked by the murder of George Floyd in the US a few weeks ago now, perhaps nearly a month ago now.
Yeah, I think we are coming close to a month on the murder of several, now becoming more by the day, Black individuals by the police in America. And we're about 2 weeks out at the time of recording from the beginning of the protests.
As I said, I've been off Instagram for this time and been mainly consuming my news via you know, outlets like The Guardian and The New York Times I subscribe to, and The New Yorker and, you know, BBC. So it's been a very, very different perspective, I think, for me, taking into those things and kind of using that information to take what action I can, rather than being on Instagram, which, Rue, I think has been something that you've been quite engaged in. Am I right?
Yes. And what's been really interesting, we're definitely sort of on opposite sides of this conversation. And granted, you know, social media is not the heart of this issue. But I was sort of at a point where I was feeling like I wanted to stop being on social media. I was kind of tired of seeing a lot of moral posturing on there. And then all of this kickstarted, and I found that social media became such an invaluable resource, and that I was getting information on protests that were happening near me and news that I wasn't seeing covered on the New York Times, and especially a lot of trans people being murdered that weren't covered by major news sources were being covered on Instagram. And especially, like, my husband Gabriel and I became very involved in attending protests and giving out supplies and all that, and using social media to connect with other people who are marching and say, okay, where are you guys going to be today? We'll show up with water, we'll show up with supplies. It sort of became this, I don't know, anti-mainstream news source that's been incredibly helpful the past few weeks. So I've been feeling extremely grateful for Instagram, which is something that I haven't felt for a long time.
It's so interesting that Instagram has become this kind of amazing tool for change.
Yeah. And I mean, we mustn't forget that Instagram is owned by Mark Zuckerberg, who obviously is more of a Trump supporter than he lets on, and is definitely controlled and policed to some degree by people who are not invested in sharing these stories. But it has been just very inspiring to see the way that it allows people to come together and to meet up in these places to protest in a way that wouldn't be possible without this sort of grassroots news outlet.
Of course, there's been a lot of conversation from all different sides about kind of the virtues and the negatives of using social media to kind of represent yourself as an ally to the Black Lives Matter movement, which of course Ruby both and I are, and so there's been a lot of debate about how, as white people, how useful that is or not. And I think we should say that, you know, as white women, we are very aware that we might be and probably are approaching this in a way that is wrong and not necessarily helpful. But from my perspective, I do feel that, as you say, it's been an incredible tool, and I would like to leave that space open for people of color to be able to have their voices heard at the minute, at a time which feels like change could really be enacted.
Yes. And I also want to acknowledge that we know that we're going to make mistakes in this conversation. We're going to make mistakes moving forward. And at any time, if people want to reach out to us in our email, which is rubyandlauragetdressed@gmail.com, or on our social media channels and say, hey, here's something that you misspoke about, or here's something that I want you to talk about instead, we're so open to those suggestions. And we love to lift up small brands, individuals, important resources. So please, if you feel compelled to share any of that with us and things that might be relevant to share on here, we would love to see them.
Absolutely. We really want to hear what you guys have to say, because I've noticed so much that often, you know, white voices have so much of the airways, and it shouldn't necessarily be the case. But we do have this podcast, so we do have the chance to, you know, spread the word and support some things. So do let us know if you would like us to do that.
Fashion isn't always the most important tool in these moments, as much as we wish it could be. Wearing clothes, buying clothes, talking about clothes is never a substitute for creating political change, for activism, for donating money to charity. So just keep that in mind and move forward, knowing that these are all interwoven parts of that big picture of activism.
Absolutely. I mean, that having been said, you know, we do have to acknowledge that we work in an industry that often celebrates, you know, Black culture and the work of Black people, but doesn't really, you know, it often falls very much at the hurdle of supporting those people as well.
I think in every aspect of diversity and of inclusion, fashion has championed itself as this sort of pinnacle of diversity and, you know, of being accepting of counterculture people, of people excluded from the mainstream. And so many people who I know who work in fashion have that idea of themselves that, oh, it's a band of outsiders who are celebrating things not popular in mainstream media. But it's, you know, really well and truly time that we start exploring the long, dark history that fashion has of stealing from Black people and from communities of color as well.
There are so many issues that are brought to light in this conversation, not least that in the past, certain Black fashion designers haven't been celebrated in the way that they could have been, you know, just the likes of Willie Smith or Oswald Boating, to name but a few, but also that those in the boardrooms right now, only a handful of people of color really are in those top jobs.
Right. And I think that's what I've been seeing a lot of on social media, and a question that I've had for myself long before this even started, but that fashion presents a very forward-facing image of diversity, of, you know, mixed groups of models and sort of different people in those forward-facing positions. But in the boardroom, in the, you know, investors who are investing in brands, it's a completely different story.
Mm. Well, I think that's something that's been kind of quite crucial. And another reason why I wanted to step away from Instagram a bit too is because everything, not just about the Black Lives Matter movement, but a lot of what is important in our society right now remains about the optics of the thing rather than the work that's being done behind the scenes. And fashion, of course, is an industry that prides itself on running on the optics of the situation, of presenting you know, a diverse range of models, of showing imagery that I feel a lot of times fetishizes the Black body rather than really celebrates it. And I think that is a real tension that we've seen sort of play out in this industry.
Yeah, and I honestly think that it wouldn't have been kicked into high gear, this conversation, in the same way if it weren't for, you know, the incredibly traumatic events happening right now. Because as much as we've known, and as other people have known, that there are issues in the industry, the fight to change them has never been more outspoken and more prevalent than right now. So I'm cautiously optimistic about where that's going to go.
I think it's very difficult for people to understand that racism, as it happens, isn't just conscious hate. It's also implicit in unconscious bias.
Yeah, and I've even been trying to sort of unpack and think about my own complicity in this problem. And a big thing that I've been thinking about is sort of the blind spots that I've had being a freelancer in this industry, because while I love, you know, being only held accountable to my views and being able to speak on what I care to talk about at any given moment, it's also allowed me to sort of turn a blind eye to what might be happening in these companies that I have worked for, especially because one source that I write for that I won't comment on too much, but has been very publicly called out for their treatment of their staff of color, and that I sort of had no idea that that was going on and never even thought to question it because I was so much on the outside, but that I could have used my voice in those moments to just sort of question and say, hey, what is going on here? What's the makeup of your team? So that has been definitely very eye-opening and sort of difficult to confront.
I've been thinking very similarly. In the same way, have I been in situations where I have, you know, have I been in situations where I haven't made someone else's life easier, where I've benefited, you know, whether it's implicitly or explicitly, from privilege due to the color of my skin? I think there are so many of these quite complicated conclusions that we could really unpack when it comes to fashion, but I'm conscious that they can lead into many, many other sort of tributaries of this general dynamic. Fashion is by no means alone being an industry that runs very heavily on, you know, nepotism and those kinds of structural hierarchies, but I'm conscious that it might be one of those conversations that leads away from looking very directly and confronting systemic racism.
Yeah, and I know we won't dive into media too much because we're going to sort of play a little bit of a waiting game and see what happens in there, but I have been just thinking a bit about sort of those larger media sources as a whole, like Vogue with Anna Wintour, and thinking about how Black voices, Black individuals have changed Teen Vogue and British Vogue, I think, for the better, with Elaine Willitroth and Lindsay Peoples-Wagner doing Teen Vogue, which has really become an incredible news source, a just beautiful celebration of teenage humanity worldwide in a variety of religions, races, gender spectrums, that it just absolutely was not when I was growing up and reading Teen Vogue. And then obviously Edward Enfield completely changing British Vogue, taking something that was perhaps a bit stuffy and tired and just completely revitalizing it.
If you've been following the coverage that British Vogue online has been giving the Black Lives Matter movement, it's been really thought-provoking. You know, article after article have just been completely compelling, from the likes of, you know, Yomi Adegoke wrote a wonderful piece about why we need to rethink the pics or it didn't happen. I really recommend that piece if people haven't read it. Efua Hirsch, who also wrote a wonderful piece in The Guardian, a number of wonderful pieces in The Guardian, but Efua Hirsch wrote a piece today that was really, really excellent, also on British Vogue, on Black history lessons that schools should be teaching, as well as Janiyah Future Khan. These are just a few of the pieces that I'm referencing. British Vogue has created some really incredible content that I think it's clear wouldn't have been pioneered as well had the leadership not been of a Black gay man who is really agitating the system.
Absolutely. And we'll link all those pieces in the show notes so that everyone can read them and sort of see that proof that when you put a Black voice at the head of a magazine like this, it changes so much for the better. Also, I wanted to bring up, have you seen, you've been off social media, but the TikTok Vogue Challenge, Edward Enfield has been sharing them on his Instagram, and it gives people the opportunity to sort of Photoshop themselves into the British Vogue cover.
I haven't seen. I do miss a lot of joy from being on social media, but tell me about Edward Enfield's Vogue TikTok Challenge, because I always want to hear about that.
People take the photos themselves and sort of Photoshop them into the Vogue cover.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, and a lot of them also have been making these sort of, I don't want to say fake because they created them, but they'll say Vogue Africa or Vogue Kenya, et cetera, and just sort of highlighting this issue that doesn't exist. There's an entire continent of the world that doesn't have its own Vogue, despite the fact that we know that it's, you know, a pinnacle of style and a place with a completely unique stylistic culture of its own. And a lot of people have been sharing these sort of TikTok Vogue covers and saying, but Vogue could have looked like this all along. And that really just sort of hit home for me, where I was like, yeah, these images are amazing. And these are stuff that teenagers are taking in their basements, styling these beautiful portraits of themselves. Why couldn't we have had this, you know, years ago?
Please do share that in the show notes. I mean, something that I think has been really interesting, we touched a bit on Teen Vogue and the importance of like listening to teenagers throughout the world, but this is exactly a moment where we need to hear teen voices. You know, I often question myself at 27, feeling like I have become, you know, jaded and conscious of certain structures, whether it's in the workplace or in, you know, personal relationships that I'm not necessarily happy or proud of. And I think listening to younger voices is absolutely the thing to be doing right now too. There were two videos actually that I've been watching recently that I think are interesting to anyone who has interest in the Black Lives Matter movement, as well as in art or fashion. One is a video that Efua Hirsch has done for Show Studio, which unpacks Britain's colonial past in a very modern light. And the other is Arthur Jaffer's incredible work, Love is the Message, The Message is Death, that has been put on YouTube. And if you haven't seen that work, I really recommend. I met Arthur a few years ago and he came to do an interview when I was at Show Studio, and he's an incredibly inspirational individual, and this work speaks to so many different issues. The use of, you know, the use of Black culture in terms of memes on the internet, police brutality, the concept of the Black body in culture, and it's just a really incredible and devastating piece of work. And that is on YouTube, and I will share that with you so you can pop it in the show notes.
I've been thinking about just some actionable responses, because obviously it's very easy to get lost in the stream of terrible news and of feeling helpless. And particularly when it comes to your workplace, I think it's challenging to find a way to make a difference and to disrupt things. So I've been trying to think about just ways to make a clean and clear difference. One of which is just, you know, reaching out to everyone I work with or who listeners might work with and questioning the makeup of their teams, their editorial teams, their staff, all that, which I'm going to try to be more vocal about. And then I was also very inspired by what the CFDA shared, which was a sort of actionable program that they are implementing. And I'll read out from their Instagram because I'm just very inspired by this. The CFDA will create an in-house employment program specifically charged with placing Black talent in all sectors of the fashion business to help achieve a racially balanced industry. This program will be tasked with identifying Black creatives and pairing these individuals with companies looking to hire. The CFDA will also create a mentorship program and an internship program focused on placing Black students and recent graduates within the established companies in the fashion sector. The CFDA will implement and make available to our members a diversity inclusion training program. And then they're making donations to different organizations. But I just liked that idea of providing clear pathways into the fashion industry for Black individuals.
I think that's so important. I'm so thrilled to hear that. I haven't read about the CFDA doing this. It's so great to hear an actual list of things that are pragmatic and also possible that a fashion company will be actioning.
Yeah, and I've also been very interested in Aurora James, who's the founder of Brother Velly's. Amazing clothing line, phenomenal shoes, some of the coolest shoes like actually in the world. And she's Black, and on the first or second day of all this sort of taking over social media, she posted her creation of something called the 15% pledge. And she said, I'm asking you to commit by buying 15% of your products from Black owned businesses, because Black people represent 15% of the population. We should represent 15% of shelf space. And she sent this to Whole Foods, Target, Walmart, Saks, Sephora, Net-a-Porter, Barnes & Noble, Home Depot, countless other businesses. And it sort of, while that's targeted at large businesses, I started thinking about myself and my own closet and how I pride myself on being an inclusive shopper and supporting small brands and handmade clothes and all that. And I thought, okay, that's something I can do, not in this moment, but in the long term, commit to making my closet 15% Black. To fill your shelves of your store with 15% Black-owned businesses should be something that's easy to do. And I hope that more companies sign on. I see that she's had Target and Sephora already agree. Oh, no, not Target, sorry. Just Sephora.
Sephora, definitely.
Yeah.
But still, that's very, you know, it's a big, big step. And for Sephora to sign on means that others will follow.
Yeah, and I think I have one list that a lovely girl who I work with, Elizabeth Tampkin, has compiled that I'll put in the show notes, that is over 500 Black-owned brands for clothing, jewelry, home goods, really everything beautiful. She's done an amazing job, and she's a rather prolific shopper. So it's a very comprehensive list. and I'll put that in the show notes because I found it to be pretty helpful.
I'll take a look as well. And if there are any great British brands that I'm conscious of too, I'll pop some of those in. There's no shortage of incredible homegrown talent over here, and not just homegrown talent, you know, young Black and POC designers who are being pioneered by the BFC in many, many ways, but we could always do more. And shopping is something that we know how to do.
Exactly. And like I said off the top of this episode, shopping is never, ever, ever a replacement for petitioning for change, for calling your elected officials, etc. Shopping is contributing to capitalism, which is part of this whole problem. But if you're using your shopping power to support Black-owned brands, that's incredible. So I'm going to commit myself to doing that, and I hope that others will as well.
I also just wanted to flag that actually, while we're having this conversation, London Fashion Week has just happened digitally. It made more of a gentle online splash, I would say, than necessarily would have done. But still, the lineup, the gender-neutral lineup, definitely highlighted some quite extraordinary designers, and one of which I wanted to just give a shout out to is Bianca Saunders, who I have known for a couple of years professionally, whose first collection was accompanied by a zine called Personal Politics. That was her graduate collection when she graduated from the RCA. And she has just launched another zine, which can be bought. I'll link that in the show notes too, that really engages in these conversations. Bianca talks a lot about elitist structures and privilege, and how her and her work can kind of change this, as well as being quite a remarkable designer who looks at the shape of bodies and the movement and physicality of both men and women to create garments that kind of avoid any obvious gender stereotyping. So I'll link her work in the show notes too, because she is really a designer who should be celebrated over the globe.
Oh, I'm excited to read that. I must say, I've been getting a lot of great fashion resources lately, fashion history resources in particular, from at Documenting Fashion, who's Dr. Rebecca Arnold. She's white, but she shares an incredible variety at all times of the year of different designers, moments in fashion history, and she's had really just the amount of photographs and of beautiful pieces she's been sharing by Black artists and Black designers is unbelievable. And also, her Instagram is at Laura Kitty, but her real name is Laura McLaws-Helms, who is a fashion and cultural historian who's also had some great treasures. And there's one I really want to link out in the show notes because it's been bringing me so much joy. It is a magazine spread about Betty Davis, who is a singer and actress. She was originally married to the musician Miles Davis, but they later divorced. And she has just like phenomenal style. And I wanted to read you one quote from this. I don't think I sent it to you yet. It's this beautiful picture of her in Rags magazine, which was a counterculture fashion magazine, wearing a sheepskin coat and then this very 70s outfit of a t-shirt with an enormous star on it and these beautiful straight leg jeans. And she says, "This is about as funky as I can get. I'd throw this stuff on to wear on Saturdays. I'm wearing a Mr. Freedom star shirt, Betsy Johnson's high-heeled lace-up sneakers, and an Icelandic sheep coat Alan Dahl made for me. This stuff doesn't need any concentration, and that's what I really call funky, but most of the time I can't just get up and throw things on. It takes me a long time to try on all my combinations. When I buy something, I take it home with me and try it on with things and then put it back in my closet. Maybe a month later, I'll be ready." And first of all, I just love that because I love obviously hearing people talking about getting dressed and hearing about how much effort this incredibly stylish woman puts into making an outfit with her new pieces. I'll link that whole spread in the show notes. I'll keep sharing things on social media as they come up. Again, please reach out to us with more that you want to share. Take time to discover Black voices in fashion, to look at the work of Black designers, and register to vote, please, if you haven't already. No matter where you live, voting makes a difference, and vote for the people who can't, for people who are incarcerated, for people who have had their voting rights taken away. Go to the polls and use yours.
And on the side of the UK, there's not an election in sight necessarily, but please do keep rallying. Please do keep protesting if that is something that you feel comfortable doing, emailing your MPs, signing the petitions that matter. Crucially, on my set, I really firmly believe in shaking up the curriculum, but also supporting the lives of people in the US who are being oppressed.
Absolutely. Keep doing it all at the same time, spending money, donating money, giving your time, giving your energy, giving what you've been educated with and changing your education.
I'm conscious that in the future, it would be great to invite more people onto this podcast in order to really diversify the opinions that are being shared. But currently, it's not the work of Black people to educate us. It's our right and our responsibility to educate ourselves on systems that fundamentally benefit us and have been put in place by our ancestors.
I look forward to speaking with you next week when the world will probably be immeasurably changed yet again.
Here's hoping to that. I hope to have similar love for clothing, but a very different world point. World point, that's not a thing.
World view.
A very different worldview, but a similar love for clothing.
Same here. Well, but goodbye for now, my fine feathered friend.
I'll talk to you next week, my fine feathered friend.